It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn more about a famous Madison playwright in our Wisconsin Legends segment.
But first, the news broke yesterday that former Wisconsin Senator and Milwaukee Bucks owner Herb Cole is selling the Milwaukee Bucks for a cool $550 million.
The new owners are two New York-based hedge fund investors who, along with Cole, say they're committed to keeping the team in Milwaukee. They've pledged funds toward a new arena, but there are still significant hurdles to getting one built. That's got people asking questions about the future of the professional basketball, about the future of professional basketball in the city.
Joining us now to talk more about the sale and the future of the team in Milwaukee is Don Walker. He's a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Business of Sports blog. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we knew this day was coming. Cole had suggested in the past that he was seeking additional investors for the team, but I think some people were surprised that he actually gave up complete ownership. What do we know about the new owners?
Well, we're still learning quite a bit about the new owners, but one thing we can say with real certainty is they have an awful lot of money in their wallets.
Yeah.
They have agreed to pay $550 million, as you reported, and pledged at least $100 million toward construction of a new arena. Folks that I've spoken with in the sports industry business say that is highly unusual for a prospective owner or owners to make that kind of a commitment. The $550 million, I should point out, is an eye-popping number, if for no other reason that the Milwaukee Bucks are generally considered to be the least valued team in the NBA. Forbes magazine, as recently as January, valued them at $405 million. So former Senator Cole certainly got a premium on his investment.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet deal. Now the question, though, is, I mean, that's a huge difference, though. It's valued at $405 million in January. It sells for $555 million, plus they're throwing in another million, $100 million for the idea of a new venue. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I think what's happening here, first of all, is you have to keep in mind, and this is based on conversations I've had with sports industry people, for those who are wealthy investors, there's a lot of money out there in the marketplace, so there's money to be spent. Secondly, assuming you're a basketball fan, an NBA franchise is a precious asset. There are only 30 of them around. Consequently, there is going to be demand for them among people who have the financial wherewithal to pay for one. And in this case, the bidding, there was approximately 9 very serious bidder groups for this team. And the company that was handling the sale for Senator Cole, Allen & Company, based in New York, said simply the bidding went up, but this particular group went in with a very high bid, stuck to it, did their homework, and convinced the senator that they were the right team pair to take over the team.
Now, is this kind of like if you buy an old classic car that's in really bad shape, but you can fix it up and it's worth more money? Is that the deal with this whole thing?
Well, I think there is some of that, but also my sense is that the other attraction for these gentlemen was the opportunity to build a new arena, again, assuming there's public support for that, and that, of course, is not a given. But I think it was attractive to them to have the potential to build an arena to their liking with, you know, all the bells and whistles that newer arenas have.
And then those bells and whistles can make a lot of money, too, right? Is that part of it as well?
Well, absolutely. Just this afternoon, I was at the BMO Harris Bradley Center, the current home of the Milwaukee Bucks, and was reminded again of some of the shortcomings in the arena. As an example, there are only 7,000 lower bowl seats in the Bradley Center. Most NBA arenas have upwards of 10,000 or more lower bowl seats. These, of course, are seats that are considered the best viewing for a basketball game. So there are things like that. There are issues about the suites at the current Bradley Center, and I'm thinking that the new owners feel that they can build a better mousetrap and attract more people and generate more revenue for the Bucks.
Now, the new owners have pledged to keep the team in Milwaukee. That seems to be an important thing to Herb Cole, I think, in making the deal, right? So do you think that's going to happen, though? Because, I mean, some people say, remember the Seattle Supersonics.
Well, I agree. Nothing is certain in life, and I do. I'm not prepared to say that they have made this lifelong commitment to keep the team in Milwaukee. And I'll give you an example. If there is significant public opposition to providing some measure of public support to complete the financing for a new arena, there could very well be a scenario in which these two owners walk away. Do I think that might happen? I don't know. That's going to get played out over the next few years. But both the senator and the two gentlemen buying the team have indicated that there will have to be some form of additional public support, whether that's in the form of sales taxes or what have you, I don't know.
Now, Herb Kohl has said he's going to put $100 million in. The new owners have said they're going to put $100 million in, but it's a $400 million project. Do you think the fact that they're willing to put so much skin in the game could make it easier to convince people in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin that this is something to support?
No question about it. That announcement yesterday, as far as I was concerned, was almost as important as the announcement of the sale of the team. It very much gives the arena construction debate a jump start. $400 million has been bandied about as a price tag for a new arena, but those kinds of things do tend to get higher over time. So $400 million may be a floor for a cost of a new arena. Could very well approach $450 million or more. It all depends on the design, and we won't know that for a very long time.
Have you done any research on the situation with other teams and other cities where they've had a condition where they wanted a new facility and wound up walking or anything like that?
Not necessarily. I mean, in most cases, professional sports franchises, with the support of their commissioner as well as key elected officials, generally speaking, across the country, have been able to convince the public of the need to fund these arenas. And I should point out, in the interest of fairness and balance, that there are very few sports economists who would agree on, you know, they would disagree on a lot of things, but one thing they generally agree on is that these new stadiums, arenas, are not necessarily economic generators. And so that debate we will hear more and more in the coming months.
So if the arena winds up not being built, if, as people debate it, they determine that's not the thing to do you think it's fair to say that the team is as good as gone?
Well, Senator Kohl said it himself. He says the money will be gone. And I would read into that not only would his own money be gone, but these owners could very well walk away. Now, we don't know the circumstances of the sale agreement, but it seemed pretty clear to me in listening to Senator Kohl yesterday is that if there is no arena, that makes this sale problematic at best.
Now, the sale isn't final until the NBA approves it. Is there any reason to think that it would be denied?
They're meeting as we speak right now. There is not a vote expected this week on approving the sale. It'll likely come in the next few months, probably via telephone conference call. I don't see anything at this juncture that would stand in the way of a successful sale.
Well, Don, thanks so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Don Walker is a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. American playwright and novelist Thornton Wilder won 3 Pulitzer Prizes for the novel The Bridge at San Luis Rey and for the plays Our Town and The Skin of Our Teeth. Plus, he won the U.S. National Book Award for the novel The Eighth Day.
Wilder was born in Madison on April 17, 1897, 117 years ago today. His nephew, Tappan Wilder, joins us from California to celebrate his life and his work. Tappan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Cynthia. Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for making the time. What brought Wilder's family to Madison?
Well, their father, Amos, was looking to buy a newspaper, and he got at least partial ownership of the Wisconsin State Journal in 1894, bought a share, and brought a new wife out there, and they family lived there. There were 4 kids born pretty quickly. And they lived until 1906 when he went on to China. He fell afoul of in part of La Follette, and that was not a good enemy to make in the state of Wisconsin in 1906.
That's funny.
So they moved to Hong Kong.
And how long did he stay here?
Well, that was the 1894 to 1906. There you are.
Okay.
That was it.
And tell us a little bit about your uncle's first writings. What were they like?
Well, there's a lot of romance in them. The Bridge of San Luis Rey, the Cabala, the Woman of Andros. Those are the novels that brought him really to great fame as a writer. You can go way back before that, because by the age of 15, he was already writing three-minute plays for three people and some longer plays that we know of. He was writing all the time, but they were often romantic. There were lots of knights and all the other things that people throw into things. What was fascinating was his early fascination in form. And he was also was a student, you know. He'd read Ibsen. He'd write a little play that would involve Ibsen. He'd meet some neighbors, perhaps, and he'd write a play about that. But it was all but very interested in form. There was a huge amount of discipline in his life already as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was very dramatic. I mean, the deepest instincts, I think, were very dramatic.
Right. Well, he won his first...
That's a big question you've asked. I could talk an hour and a half about that, but I know we'll move on.
I appreciate your effort here. Well, he won his first Pulitzer Prize at the age of 30 for The Bridge of San Luis Rey, as you mentioned.
Right.
But what made that novel such a success and so early in his career?
Well, some people are still asking that question, because here was a novel that was the publishers expected to sell. They published a little over 3,000 copies, which is a few more than the first one he published. But they thought it was for a very sophisticated audience, and right off the bat, at the end of the first year, it sold over 300,000 copies, if you count England in the American totals. It was a huge, huge story. Well, it's a great story. It's got everything. People die in a bridge, marvelous characters, set in 18th century Peru. It had an extraordinary style. It stood against the Dreiser tradition, and some people were tired of that. This is long ago now. But we read it, I think, for what we find in it ourselves. And I get letters, as he did, from people who are emotionally deeply moved by that novel today. And when there's a terrible tragedy, its last lines are often read, commonly read. Mm. And thousands of copies of this book are still sold. So it's really about us. So it's like our town, except it's a fictional version. And we see ourselves in it. And it asks questions that are so common to all our lives. Russell Banks, who wrote the marvelous introduction to it, calls it the most perfect moral fable in American literature.
Mm.
Well, there you are. You go read it and tell me what you think.
We'll have another
available.
Show on that. Yeah. Well, Wilder was part of this generation of great writers, F. Scott Fitzgerald and John O'Hara, and they all went on to write for Hollywood as well. Did Wilder go on to do so?
Oh, sure. You know, listen, that's where the money was in the 1930s. And he certainly did well with The Bridge of San Luis Rey, but there was this thing called the Great Depression, and he was supporting family and all sorts of people, including himself. Yeah, he turned up there for the first time in 1934. He had an agent in Hollywood who got him a big deal, and he wrote a treatment for Goldwyn, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer of the day, for a Joan of Arc treatment for a movie never made. And he helped out in a few others. Had a marvelous time. Was the key at every party. Marvelous, roller skating with Disney, I mean, a marvelous time. And then he left. He used to say, spend more than 8 or 10 weeks in Hollywood and you lose your soul. He took the check, that was what he needed, and he left.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really come back until early 40s, when he was asked by Hitchcock to come out, and he wrote a very famous movie called Shadow of a Doubt. And he helped with Our Town movie made in the same period. But he never went back in any regular way, although people offered him jobs all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't depend on it. When it was there, he needed it. It was there if he wanted it, and when he'd pick up a little work when he wanted it.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit about your relationship with him. How often did you see him? Tell us a little bit about maybe a side of him that most people don't know.
Well, I was born in 1940, and Thornton Wilder lived his base for many years with Hamden, Connecticut, just outside New Haven. And I would see him, and I went to college in New Haven. So after about 1958 till really I left there in 1979 with a few years, I was pretty much there at the university, both as a student and later as an employee. I would see him when he came there. Wilder, my uncle, was a, you know, would arrive, I'd get a phone call, and I'd be whisked off to a wonderful dinner. This is an extraordinarily, this is a man who knew everybody. He wasn't like, you know, he wasn't like Hemingway, his friend Hemingway, who could drink anybody under the table and also knock them down. And he wasn't in the front pages for his behavior, like his great friend Scott Fitzgerald, who had trouble, all kinds of troubles. And, he and his wife were big news. But he was a very convivial man. He loved people. He loved to meet people. And he was awful good to his nephew. He was very interested in when he met you. He'd ask you 20 questions right off the bat about what you were talking about, and you'd want to talk to him about it. He didn't want to talk about himself. He wanted to hear what really was important in your life. And I think as human a person as I've ever known, but also very private. He was a very private person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was the eyes on the wall, always he spent over 200 days a year writing in other places than home. His base was Hamden, Connecticut, and he had a study there. But much of his work was done in Europe, was done on boats. Once he would offer 20 months to Douglas, Arizona, in the early 60s, where he began to write what some people think of his greatest novel. You've mentioned it, The Eighth Day, which won the National Book Award. Now, what was Douglas, Arizona? It was, in those days, one of the great copper smelting sites of the world. You know, can imagine the sky dark with smoke. He never mentions any kind of pollution. He just wanted to get away from what he called a coterie. And he used to tell his nephew all the time, listen to the multitude, don't get caught up in the coterie. That was the Midwesterner in him, by the way.
Something to keep in mind for all of us, I think. So yeah. Many of his novels, so much of his work was romantic in nature. Would you say that he's a romantic himself?
No. No, that's the wrong term. I described that when I described his early work. He's pretty hard-headed. You know, our town is a very, very tough play. And yeah. So is the Bridge of St. Louis Ray, by the way. You know, this the great novel. These are very, very tough. They ask, as Thornton used to say, it was the job of the writer to try and pose the question right. And we sometimes, because of their particular association for many years with the high schools, have tended to... critics would look at this and people would look back on it from their experiences maybe as some kind of a romantic. I use the phrase, they think our town is a kind of a chocolate milkshake. Well, it's not a chocolate milkshake. It's a very tough play. And so I wouldn't use that term. I think he's a very complex, interesting writer. And the fact that all his works are in print today, all his novels, all his major plays, even the short one-act plays, which do so well, says that he speaks to our time, and it's a kind of golden age for my uncle right now, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. I was taking a look at Penelope Niven's biography of Thornton Wilder.
You bet.
Yeah. You spoke at his funeral in 1975, and you read a passage of his own work. Can you share a little bit about what you chose and why you chose it?
Well, it wasn't my choice only. I worked that out with my Aunt Isabel, his sister. There were four Wilder kids born in Madison, and they proved to be all writers, by the way. They're all being rediscovered, Isabel among them. My father's works are going back in print, and Charlotte's poems are being republished. It's kind of an interesting time for the Wilder family. But they're going back to the service... Isabel, I wanted some of them, and I did have a chance to add one or two things that I liked from the. But you know, that's so long ago. You know, I'm not a kid anymore. I can't remember exactly.
No
it was
worries.
A negotiation. Let's
yeah.
put it that way.
Well, Tappan Wilder, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tappan Wilder. He's the nephew of playwright and novelist Thornton Wilder, who was born in Madison, Wisconsin on this day in 1897.
Our next guest is on a quest to find the world's strangest sounds, from sand dunes that sing to an oil tank with the world's longest reverberation. He says the world is full of sonic wonders, and we're hearing one right now. This is music played on the Great Stalactpipe organ in Virginia, which I'm guessing is made out of stones or something like that.
He also says that by unraveling the mysteries of these sonic wonders, there's a lot we can learn about sound and about the world around us.
Well, joining us now is Trevor Cox. He's a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford in England, and he's the author of The Sound Book, The Science of Sonic Wonders of the World. Trevor, thanks for joining us today.
Great to join you.
Now, you're an acoustic engineer, so I think it's probably fair to say that you know a lot about how sound behaves, yet you had an epiphany about sound when you were in a sewer. Now, how did that happen?
Yeah, I think a lot of acoustic engineering is spent sort of trying to deal with problems like, I don't know, noise and, you know, how to design classrooms which sound good. And what happened in the sewer was I heard a very remarkable sound. I heard the sound spiraling around the inside. I mean, the sewer is a cylindrical shape, and the sound seemed to cling to the walls. And it kind of made me think that, actually, as well as thinking about, you know, how to design things to sound better, I ought to celebrate the most remarkable sounds of the world. And that sent me on a quest to find them.
Now, it's interesting, though, in a sewer that you would do that. I mean, you'd think your smell would take control in a situation like that.
The smell was pretty dominant. I mean, it wouldn't be a place I would normally go. Funny enough, I was asked to do a radio interview to comment on the acoustics, which took me down there.
Uh-huh.
But it's not a place I should be going to again. I can tell you that.
Well, that's good. Now, could you talk a little bit about what you mean exactly by sonic wonder?
Well, I think it's something that you kind of know when you meet what it is. It's something which stands out as being unusual, something which, you know, makes you go, wow. I mean, you mentioned that oil tank in Scotland. I mean, that actually now has a world record, so that makes it stand out as being remarkable. And some of them are because, you know, they just so unusual. Like, you were playing this great stalactpipe organ there, which is made out of cave formations.
Wow.
There's only one of those in the world, so rare things are also sonic wonders.
So that's made out of you know, sort of the cave formations.
Yeah, it's made out of the stalactites. Back in the 1950s, an engineer decided to make them. And there's actually an organ keyboard in there. And every time you strike one of the keys, it taps one of these stalactites with a little hammer. And therefore, you can play tunes on it.
Do you think that people take sound for granted because we're more visually oriented most of the time?
I think that's certainly true, that in the modern world we communicate so much with vision, you know, by reading and looking at imagery, that I think we do take sound more for granted. And one of the things I talk about in the sound book is actually the importance of us thinking about sound. I mean, take, for example, when we go and see prehistoric sites, ancient sites, our ancestors would have seen sound as being more important, you know, would have seen the senses more in the round. So when you go to a stone circle, unless you think about the sound of that place, you're kind of missing a bit of the story.
So you kind of feel like you're trying to open up people's minds so they're more aware of it, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's pleasure to be had. In the same way as you might go into the countryside and look at a beautiful view, there's pleasure to be had in hearing unusual and pleasurable sounds. So I'm just trying to make people think that sometimes it's nice to take your MP3 headphones off and listen to the world.
It sounds like you're a little bit of a pioneer in this area, because when you went out to research the sonic wonders of the world, you weren't able to really find a whole lot of work that other people had done, right?
Yeah, that was what kind of surprised me. When I got out of the sewer, I thought of this idea of looking for remarkable sounds. I went online. I thought, that's bound to be loads of websites doing this. But actually, no, there wasn't any. So I set one up, which is actually still there, called sonicwonders.org, where I asked people to give me suggestions of places I should visit. So, yeah, there's a bit of pioneering going on.
Yes. Now, did a lot of people dive in and give you ideas?
Yeah, particularly now the book's out, there's quite a lot of new ideas coming up on the website that I'll have to sort of pencil in to try and see. But, no, it took quite a lot of research as well. I mean, it takes something like an echo. So echoes are great fun to play with. But actually finding out about them is quite difficult, because people don't write about them very much nowadays. Go back to Victorian times, loads of people, natural historians, natural philosophers were writing about them, but not anymore. So actually finding out ones which are currently working now is quite difficult.
So natural historians would write about echoes in the Victorian times?
Yeah, in the same way as you might sort of decide to collect butterflies, people would go and collect echoes. It was that sort of thing going on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they would write about it. So these people who were writing, observing the natural world would observe echoes as well and write about those.
Wow. Well, why don't we listen to an echo that you discovered, which is the one that I think is the world record. This is the oil storage complex in Scotland, right? Is that the one?
Oh, I thought you were going to play it. Yes, this is an oil storage depot which was built just before the start of World War II to protect the Royal Navy shipping oil from German bombing. So it's in the side of a hill near a little place called Inchendown, which is right at the top of Scotland.
Okay, so we'll listen to this sound in that oil storage complex in Scotland. Here we go. Now, that sound, could you explain it? The sound is a gun going off in an oil storage tank, right?
Yeah, it's just a huge concrete vault. So when you go into it, it's a couple of football pitches long. It's very tall and very wide. I mean, you can't really see this because there's no lighting in it.
Right.
So you've just got what your head torch can see. But, yeah, it's just a huge, great volume of concrete, concrete cavern. And to measure it, to get what's called the reverberation time, which is actually what we're measuring there, we fire a gun. It's kind of quite a common, quick and easy way to measure it, particularly as this place has no mains electricity, so there's nothing more clever we can do.
Right.
And that time it takes the sound to die away in a concert hall is really important for the orchestral sound. It would take a couple of seconds. In that oil tank, it takes over a minute for the sound to die away to nothing.
Wow, so if you just stood there and listened to that gun, it would go on for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, if you went got a nice bass instrument out, if you were to get out something like a tuba or a trombone, it would go on for a couple of minutes. It really does. The sound just lasts an incredibly long time in that space.
Now, this thing used to be used to store oil. Were you concerned about shooting a gun off in there?
There were some various safety discussions, one of which is, there's no door to these places. It wasn't designed to be got into, so you have to go down the oil pipe. So there was discussion about
really?
The safety. Yeah, you have to be put on a trolley and pushed through the old oil pipes. And the only people who normally used to do this were the people in the army who had to, unfortunately, go in when they had to repair the place. So there's no door. And, there was a discussion about what the flash point was of shipping oil and whether the gun would set it off. But it's safe enough. The oil is not that flammable.
So you're pretty serious about this business, then. You're not afraid.
No, it's quite interesting. People have remarked on some of these intrepid trips. I just kind of did them, really, without really thinking about them. It's only in retrospect it seems that, I've been down a sewer, I've been into deserts, I've been into oil depots. I have been some very strange places on my travels.
We're going to play some more of those as we talk about this, just to let people know who you are and everything. This is Trevor Cox. He's a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford, and he wrote the sound book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. We're talking about the sonic wonders of the world with him. In just a few minutes, we'll give you a chance. If you have any ideas for interesting sounds that you'd like to let Trevor Cox know about, we'll give you a chance to call in and participate in that conversation. But first, I want to listen to another interesting place that you – so we go from an oil tank that you had to crawl into to a spy station, the Teufelsberg spy station in Germany. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, it's on the outskirts of Western Berlin. So after World War II, they had a lot of rubble in Berlin. Of course, Berlin was blockaded. Western Berlin was blockaded. So they made a hill, which is Teufelsberg, called Devil's Mountain, a huge, great hill of the rubble. And on the top of it, they stuck a spy station where the Allies used to spy on East Germany and Russia. So up on top of this derelict spy station, there is spherical rooms. And what these rooms used to have inside them, they used to have antennae to all the spy equipment used to be in them. And these sort of these dome shapes have the most amazing acoustics. They weren't designed for those acoustics, but they do have amazing acoustics. So a musician suggested I should go there, and so I visited it. It's quite a derelict and disused place. You have to sign when you go to the place to say that you realize there's lots of holes in the place and you could kill yourself if you fell off the edges. Provided
wow.
You're safe, it has got the most amazing acoustic.
But you decided not to shoot a gun there, though.
Well, I was on my family holidays, and in Europe you don't carry guns around, so I took balloons with me. So, yeah, I mean, actually carrying a starting pistol for, say, Inchendown, there's quite a lot of rules in Britain about
that's
what
true.
You can and cannot do.
They'd stop you at the border, I think. So let's listen to the sound of a balloon being popped at the spy station in Germany. Here we go. Wow. So that was just one balloon?
That's one balloon. Every single ricochet you heard is a focused echo. So the sound, I was stood in the middle of the dome there, and the sand was going up, and because the dome's a big concave surface, it's like a sort of shaving mirror, like a concave shaving mirror. It focuses the sand all the way back to you, and you get these repeated paths going back and forth, and that's what those ricochets are.
Wow, that's fascinating. We're talking with Trevor Cox about the sonic wonders of the world. We'll hear some more of them in just a few minutes, but you can join the conversation too. Do you know of some places that have a particularly interesting sound that you'd like to share with Trevor Cox? Because he is keeping track of these kind of things. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Have you ever been to a place where the sound completely blew you away? What was different about it? You can tell us about that and your experience from experiencing interesting sounds. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with acoustic engineer Trevor Cox about the sonic wonders of the world, the places where sound behaves in unusual and sometimes amazing ways. And you can join with your comments and questions at 800-642-1234. You want to share an interesting sound that you've heard in an interesting place? Feel free to do that. You can join that conversation at 800-642-1234. Trevor Cox has been in some interesting places. Earlier, he told us how he went into an oil tank with a gun and fired it to hear the longest echo in the world. He was at a spy station in Germany. And this is just really part of your quest, right, Trevor, to find interesting sounds all over the place and visit them, really.
Yeah, I suppose what I really wanted to do was to celebrate sound. I think when a lot of books have been written recently about how noise is a terrible problem with modern world, and that's true, but I wanted something which was a bit celebratory because sound is so important to us.
It's true. I mean, that is true that a lot of times people complain about noise. You don't hear about people saying, wow, that's a really great sound. Keep making it.
Yeah, I think we do with music, but beyond that, we don't. So, and there's pleasure to be had even with just the everyday sounds. I mean, at the moment, you know, last month or so, you know, spring has awoken in England, and suddenly all the birds are out singing, and it's obviously a beautiful sound, which, being a natural sound, is also quite good for us.
Now, since a number of people listening to the show are driving around, we thought it would be good to share one sound before we go to the calls, because we do have tons of people on the phone we want to talk to and get on before we say goodbye to you, Trevor. And I want to listen to a musical highway. Could you tell us a little bit about this whole musical highway thing? I wasn't aware of it.
Yes, this is across in California. It's just outside a city called Lancaster. And it's grooves cut in the road which plays tunes when you drive across it. So you might have been down a highway where you've hit a rumble strip which has buzzed at you.
Uh-huh.
That's caused by bumps and grooves. Well, what this musical road does is sometimes the grooves are spaced far apart to give you a low note, and sometimes they're spaced close together to give you a high note, and together it forms a tune.
Well, let's listen to that. Wow, that's a musical highway from California. Now, Trevor, that seems like that would be a little disturbing if you weren't aware of it.
Yeah, the funny thing is they built it first in another place in Lancaster, rather near some houses. And as you can imagine, if you live near that, listening to that all day, and that drive you potty. So they moved it later on. So that's actually the second version of the musical road of Lancaster.
Oh, my. Well, we need to go to the phones. We have a lot of people who want to talk to you about sounds and stuff. So, again, if anybody else wants to join the conversation, the number is 800-642-1234. Let's start off with Don in Williams Bay. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, hi. The sound I wanted to bring up is in Barstow, California. It's along the old Route 66, I believe, but it's a huge train terminal in the valley down there. And in the evening, having passed through there outside my hotel room, I heard this slow moaning sound. And my buddy and I were surprised by the sound. We asked what that was. And it's the trains just slowly being positioned in the valley, but it echoes through the valley, and it's the most eerie sound. I just thought I'd bring that up.
Well, Don, thanks for that call. Trevor, I think you've actually written a little bit about this whole thing, right?
Yeah, the thing with low frequencies is that they can travel huge distances, especially if the weather conditions are right. You know, if you hear, I don't know, an outside festival, from a distance, it's just the bass you really hear. And these sounds are kind of quite hard to place where they're coming from, and they're quite hard to hear what they are. And so they do take this eerie quality on them. So there has been report, you know, there's lots of regular reports about unknown mysterious noises. So you guys done really well to actually find out what it is, because often the cause is unknown.
Well, let's go to Russ in Lodi. Russ, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, guys. I've got a couple of interesting sounds that we hear on a daily basis. I work on water utilities, especially on elevated water towers. And it's what's interesting is when we are inside the water tower working, we cannot talk to each other, even in the slightest, lowest tones, without leaving 4 or 5 seconds between each word. And so
between each word?
Right. Because the echoes overlap each other, and you cannot make out one word from another at all, speaking normally. So I'll give you an example. When you're standing next to a guy in a water tower, you have to speak this slowly, or you cannot understand what he's saying.
Wow, that's amazing. Trevor, have you ever been in a water tower before?
I've certainly been in places, not water towers, that are like that. I think of actually the Hamilton Mausoleum up near Glasgow, which is kind of a similar kind of shape to a water tower. And yes, when you've got that very strong reverberance, so the words run one into the other, the only way you can make it intelligible is either to get very close to the person you're talking to and talk into their ear, literally, or you have to space the words out to give time for the sound to die away so you can hear each separate word properly.
Now, Ted, did you have another example from your work in water utilities?
Exactly. The other one, normally we use radios or cell phones to talk to the ground. But when we're in the tank, we know that the ground crew can hear us through the overflow pipe, and it might be 200 feet long of 10-inch pipe. And you can speak in a normal tone just like this, 40 feet away from the overflow pipe, and the guy on the ground can be within 3 or 4 feet of it and hear you perfectly clearly. And then he can talk to you back up through the pipe. And if he raises his voice, it's unbelievably loud inside the water tower. But the phenomenon is that guy speaking on the ground does not reverberate in the tower. You can hear him normally, and when you talk, your words overlap, but they come out the pipe normal.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a really interesting phenomenon that the pipe will grab the words and pipe them down to the ground without the reverberation.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. Now, Trevor Cox, can you explain that from an acoustic engineer perspective?
Well, I think the first thing about the tube is that sound will carry a long way in pipe work, because normally when we talk outside, the sound's going off in all directions and it disperses and it gets quieter as we get further away. But in a pipe, it's got nowhere to go, so the sound just keeps, it doesn't get much quieter. I mean, when I was in that we described earlier on, there was an echo there where we measured the sound path. It's taken 3 kilometer, so it's a couple 2 mile round trip for the echo. So you can get huge long distances travelled in pipes. I guess this reverberance might depend on where the pipe is in the water tower. Is it near the centre? Because I've seen this tower is a cylinder. Is it near the centre or near the edge or something like that?
It's almost like a funnel. So it funnels the sound into the pipe.
Oh, right. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, there's a cave in Italy called the Ear of Dionysus, which is a funnel shape. And the story there is that Dionysus was this tyrant from sometime in BC. I can't remember the exact date. And he used to, so it's sort of upside down version of your water tower. And he used to have a little cave at the top of this sort of ear shaped cavern. And in the bottom, he used to put prisoners. And the top, he used to spy on them because it used to funnel the sound. It's not known if it's true, this story, or not, but it's a great story anyway.
Wow. Well, Ted, thanks for those stories from working in the water tanks. Let's go on to Don in La Crosse. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. We used to live in Florida for a number of years, and we go over to watch the shuttle launches, and we stand on a spot on the beach about 10 miles south of the Cape, and the sound, we'd be on the beach with surf coming in and highway noise next to us, and once the sound from the shuttle hit us, it drowned out everything. It was amazingly loud. But it was not the roar you expect. It was a snapping, popping, crackling noise. I wonder if Trevor's done any work on rocket noise.
No, I've not really worked at rocket noise. Do you think you were hearing the sonic boom? Because, of course, space-based rockets are one of the things which will give you a sonic boom.
It was just a constant crackling, snapping, popping. Really constant. I don't think the shuttle had not reached supersonic speeds at that point. It was just from the launch.
And it just overpowered all of the other sounds around you, too.
Everything. And we were 10 miles south of it.
Wow. So it was like you were hit by a wave of sound.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, space rockets certainly are, in terms of man-made sounds, they're probably one of the loudest, if not one of the loudest that we ever make. And I mean, in nature, probably the nearest you'd ever get to that would be some volcanoes going off. So, yeah, the space shuttle was incredibly loud.
Well, thanks, Don, for that story. The space shuttle is an interesting sound to hear taking off. We're talking about sounds with Trevor Cox. He's a professor of acoustic engineering and the author of the sound book, The Science and Sonic Wonders of the World. Let's go to Steve from Libertyville, Illinois. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, yeah. Trevor, I was up in Houghton, Michigan in Quincy Mine. It's an old mine, and there's a huge metal drum that they would use to coil the cable around when they to operate the mine. I went in there one day with my acoustic guitar, and I was playing in the room there, and with the metal drum in the room, it just had a really unusual reverberation. In fact, one of the the tour guy kind of peeked his head around the corner to see what I was doing. And I've always wanted to get back up there and maybe bring a recorder or something and record some of my guitar up there.
Well, Steve, thanks for that story. Trevor, playing an acoustic guitar in a mine. Have you ever done that?
No, I played I play the saxophone normally, and I've played it in some fairly strange places, like under bridge archways, but not in a mine ever. But the thing, it's very, you know, you can get some really beautiful conditions to play in. I mean, we all kind of do it. When we go into the shower in the morning, you know, if we want to have a sing there, we'll know we'll sound much better than we will do if we go and sing, you know, elsewhere in the house, because of the effect of the shower reinforcing our voice and making us sound like this, in my case, a great baritone singer, which I'm not. So the same thing can happen to mine. It reinforces sound, and this sort of reinforcement is something we seem to like, this reverberation, which is fundamental to music. It's not just in classical music. If you look at pop music production, the first thing they'll do when they record a singer's voice is add some reverberation to make the voice richer.
Well, Trevor, thanks so much. It's a great introduction to the concept of paying more attention to sound. Thanks so much for being here today.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking to Trevor Cox. If this is a sort of piqued your interest in sounds, you ought to check out his sound book. It's called The Sound Book, The Science and Sonic Wonders of the World. He also has a website, which is called sonicwonders.org.